According to the laws of nature concerning gravity and motion, laws that are among the oldest in science, space itself is a vast store of negative energy, enough to ensure that everything adds up to zero. I'll admit that unless mathematics is your thing, this is hard to grasp. But it's true. The endless web of billions upon billions of galaxies, each pulling on each other by the force of gravity, acts like a giant storage device. The universe is like an enormous battery, storing negative energy. The positive side of things, the mass and energy we see today, is like the hill. The corresponding whole, or negative side of things, is spread throughout space. So what does this mean in our quest to find out if there is a God? It means that if the universe adds up to nothing, then you don't need a God to create it. The universe is the ultimate free lunch. Since we know that the positive and the negative add up to zero, all we need to do now is to work out what, or dare I say who, triggered the whole process in the first place. What could cause the spontaneous appearance of a universe? At first, it seems a baffling problem. After all, in our daily lives, things don't just materialize out of the blue. You can't just click your fingers and summon up a cup of coffee when you feel like one. You have to make it out of other stuff like coffee beans, water, and perhaps some milk and sugar. But travel down into this coffee cup, through the milk particles, down to the atomic level, and right down to the subatomic level, and you enter a world where conjuring something out of nothing is possible. At least for a short while. That's because, at this scale, particles, such as protons, behave according to the laws of nature we call quantum mechanics. And they really can appear at random, stick around for a while and then vanish again, to reappear somewhere else. Since we know the universe itself was once very small, perhaps smaller than a proton, this means something quite remarkable. It means the universe itself, in all its mind-boggling vastness and complexity, could simply have popped into existence without violating the known laws of nature. From that moment on, vast amounts of energy were released as space itself expanded, a place to store all the negative energy needed to balance the books. But of course, the critical question is raised again. Did God create the quantum laws that allowed the Big Bang to occur? In a nutshell, do we need a God to set it up so that the Big Bang could bang? I have no desire to offend anyone of faith, but I think science has a more compelling explanation than a divine creator. Our everyday experience makes us think that everything that happens must be caused by something that occurred earlier in time. So it's natural for us to think that something, maybe God, must have caused the universe to come into existence. But when we're talking about the universe as a whole, that isn't necessarily so. Let me explain. Imagine a river flowing down a mountainside. What caused the river? Well, perhaps the rain that fell earlier in the mountains. But then what caused the rain? A good answer would be the sun that shone down on the ocean and lifted water vapor up into the sky and made clouds. Okay, so what caused the sun to shine? Well, if we look inside, we see the process known as fusion, in which hydrogen atoms join to form helium, releasing vast quantities of energy in the process. So far, so good. Where does the hydrogen come from? Answer, the Big Bang. But here's the crucial bit. The laws of nature itself tell us that not only could the universe have popped into existence without any assistance, like a proton, and have required nothing in terms of energy, but also that it is possible that nothing caused the Big Bang. Nothing. The explanation lies back with the theories of Einstein and his insights into how space and time in the universe are fundamentally intertwined. Something very wonderful happened to time at the instant of the Big Bang. Time itself began. To understand this mind-boggling idea, consider a black hole floating in space. A typical black hole is a star so massive that it has collapsed in on itself. It's so massive that not even light can escape its gravity, which is why it's almost perfectly black. Its gravitational pull is so powerful, it warps and distorts not only light, but also time. To see how, imagine a clock is being sucked into it, As the clock gets closer and closer to the black hole, it begins to get slower and slower. Time itself begins to slow down. Now imagine the clock as it enters the black hole. Well, assuming, of course, that it could withstand the extreme gravitational forces, it would actually stop. It stops not because it is broken, but because inside the black hole, time itself doesn't exist. And that's exactly what happened at the start of the universe. In the last 100 years, we have made spectacular advances in our understanding of the universe. We now know the laws that govern what happens in all but the most extreme conditions, like the origin of the universe or black holes. The role played by time at the beginning of the universe is, I believe, the final key to removing the need for a grand designer and revealing how the universe created itself. As we travel back in time towards the moment of the Big Bang, the universe gets smaller and smaller and smaller, until it finally comes to a point where the whole universe is a space so small that it is, in effect, a single, infinitesimally small, infinitesimally dense black hole. And just as with modern-day black holes floating around in space, the laws of nature dictate something quite extraordinary. They tell us that here too, time itself must come to a stop. You can't get to a time before the Big Bang, because there was no time before the Big Bang. We have finally found something that doesn't have a cause, because there was no time for a cause to exist in. For me, this means that there is no possibility of a creator, because there is no time for a creator to have existed in. People want answers to the big questions, like why we are here. They don't expect the answers to be easy, so they are prepared to struggle a bit. When people ask me if a God created the universe, I tell them that the question itself makes no sense. Time didn't exist before the Big Bang, so there is no time for God to make the universe in. It's like asking for directions to the edge of the Earth. The Earth is a sphere that doesn't have an edge, so looking for it is a futile exercise. Do I have faith? We are each free to believe what we want, and it's my view that the simplest explanation is that there is no God. No one created the universe, and no one directs our fate. This leads me to a profound realization. There is probably no heaven and afterlife either. I think belief in an afterlife is just wishful thinking. There is no reliable evidence for it, and it flies in the face of everything we know in science. I think that when we die, we return to dust. But there's a sense in which we live on, in our influence, and in our genes that we pass on to our children. We have this one life to appreciate the grand design of the universe, and for that, I am extremely grateful.
How does God's existence fit into your understanding of the beginning and the end of the universe? And if God was to exist, and you had the chance to meet him, what would you ask him?
The question is the way the universe began chosen by God for reasons we can't understand, or was it determined by a law of science? I believe the second. If you like, you can call the laws of science God, but it wouldn't be a personal God that you would meet and put questions to. Although, if there were such a God, I would like to ask, however did he think of anything as complicated as M theory in 11 dimensions?
2. How did it all begin? Hamlet said, I could be bounded in a nutshell and count myself a king of infinite space. I think what he meant was that although we humans are very limited physically, particularly in my own case, our minds are free to explore the whole universe and to boldly go where even Star Trek fears to tread. Is the universe actually infinite, or just very large? Did it have a beginning? Will it last forever, or just a long time? How can our finite minds comprehend an infinite universe? Isn't it pretentious of us even to make the attempt? At the risk of incurring the fate of Prometheus, who stole fire from the ancient gods for human use, I believe we can and should try to understand the universe, Prometheus's punishment was being chained to a rock for eternity, although happily he was eventually liberated by Hercules. We have already made remarkable progress in understanding the cosmos. We don't yet have a complete picture. I like to think we may not be far off. According to the Bushongo people of Central Africa, in the beginning there was only darkness, water, and the great god Bumba. One day Bumba, in pain from stomach ache, vomited up the sun. The sun dried up some of the water, leaving land. Still in pain, Bumba vomited up the moon, the stars, and then some animals. The leopard, the crocodile, the turtle, and finally, man. These creation myths, like many others, try to answer the questions we all ask. Why are we here? Where did we come from? The answer generally given was that humans were of comparatively recent origin because it must have been obvious that the human race was improving its knowledge and technology. So it can't have been around that long or it would have progressed even more. For example, according to Bishop Usher, the book of Genesis placed the beginning of time on the 22nd of October, 4004 BCE, at 6 PM. On the other hand, the physical surroundings, like mountains and rivers, change very little in a human lifetime. They were therefore thought to be a constant background, and either to have existed forever as an empty landscape, or to have been created at the same time as the humans. Not everyone, however, was happy with the idea the universe had a beginning. For example, Aristotle, the most famous of the Greek philosophers, believed that the universe had existed forever. Something eternal is more perfect than something created. He suggested the reason we see progress was that floods or other natural disasters had repeatedly set civilization back to the beginning. The motivation for believing in an eternal universe was the desire to avoid invoking divine intervention to create the universe and set it going. Conversely, those who believed that the universe had a beginning used it as an argument for the existence of God as the first cause or prime mover of the universe. If one believed that the universe had a beginning, the obvious questions were, what happened before the beginning? What was God doing before he made the world? Was he preparing hell for people who asked such questions? The problem of whether or not the universe had a beginning was a great concern to the German philosopher Immanuel Kant. He felt there were logical contradictions or antinomies either way. If the universe had a beginning, why did it wait an infinite time before it began? He called that the thesis. On the other hand, if the universe had existed forever, why did it take an infinite time to reach the present stage? He called that the antithesis. Both the thesis and the antithesis depended on Kant's assumption, along with almost everyone else, that time was absolute. That is to say, it went from the infinite past to the infinite future, independently of any universe that might or might not exist. This is still the picture in the mind of many scientists today. However, in 1915, Einstein introduced his revolutionary general theory of relativity. In this, space and time were no longer absolute, no longer a fixed background to events. Instead, they were dynamical quantities that were shaped by the matter and energy in the universe. They were defined only within the universe, so it made no sense to talk of a time before the universe began. It would be like asking for a point south of the South Pole. It is not defined. Although Einstein's theory unified time and space, it didn't tell us much about space itself. Something that seems obvious about space is that it goes on and on and on. We don't expect the universe to end in a brick wall, although there's no logical reason why it couldn't. But modern instruments like the Hubble Space Telescope allow us to probe deep into space. What we see is billions and billions of galaxies, of various shapes and sizes. There are giant elliptical galaxies and spiral galaxies like our own. Each galaxy contains billions and billions of stars, many of which will have planets around them. Our own galaxy blocks our view in certain directions, but apart from that, the galaxies are distributed roughly uniformly throughout space, with some local concentrations and voids. The density of galaxies appears to drop off at very large distances, but that seems to be because they're so far away and faint that we can't make them out. As far as we can tell, the universe goes on in space forever, and is much the same no matter how far it goes on. Although the universe seems to be much the same at each position in space, it is definitely changing in time. This was not realized until the early years of the last century. Up to then, it was thought the universe was essentially constant in time. It might have existed for an infinite time, but that seemed to lead to absurd conclusions. If stars had been radiating for an infinite time, they would have heated up the universe until it reached their own temperature. Even at night, the whole sky would be as bright as the sun, because every line of sight would have ended either on a star or on a cloud of dust that had been heated up until it was as hot as the stars. So the observation that we have all made that the sky at night is dark is very important. It implies that the universe cannot have existed forever in the state we see today. Something must have happened in the past to make the stars turn on a finite time ago. Then the light from very distant stars wouldn't have had time to reach us yet. This would explain why the sky at night isn't glowing in every direction. If the stars had just been sitting there forever, why did they suddenly light up a few billion years ago? What was the clock that told them it was time to shine? This puzzled those philosophers like Immanuel Kant, who believed that the universe had existed forever. But for most people, it was consistent with the idea that the universe had been created, much as it is now, only a few thousand years ago, just as Bishop Usher had concluded. However, discrepancies in this idea began to appear with observations by the 100-inch telescope on Mount Wilson in the 1920s. First of all, Edwin Hubble discovered that many faint patches of light, called nebulae, were in fact other galaxies, vast collections of stars like our sun, but at a great distance. In order for them to appear so small and faint, the distances had to be so great that light from them would have taken millions or even billions of years to reach us. This indicated that the beginning of the universe couldn't have been just a few thousand years ago. But the second thing Hubble discovered was even more remarkable. By an analysis of the light from other galaxies, Hubble was able to measure whether they were moving towards us or away. To his great surprise, he found they were nearly all moving away. Moreover, the further they were from us, the faster they were moving away. In other words, the universe is expanding. Galaxies are moving away from each other. The discovery of the expansion of the universe was one of the great intellectual revolutions of the 20th century. It came as a total surprise, and it completely changed the discussion of the origin of the universe. If the galaxies are moving apart, they must have been closer together in the past. From the present rate of expansion, we can estimate that they must have been very close together indeed, about 10 to 15 billion years ago. So it looks as though the universe might have started then, with everything being at the same point in space. But many scientists were unhappy with the universe having a beginning because it seemed to imply that physics broke down. One would have to invoke an outside agency, which for convenience one can call God, to determine how the universe began. They therefore advanced theories in which the universe was expanding at the present time but didn't have a beginning. One of these was the steady-state theory proposed by Hermann Bondi, Thomas Gold, and Fred Hoyle in 1948. In the steady-state theory, as galaxies moved apart, the idea was that new galaxies would form from matter that was supposed to be continually being created throughout space. The universe would have existed forever and would have looked the same at all times. This last property had the great virtue of being a definite prediction that could be tested by observation. The Cambridge Radio Astronomy Group under Martin Ryle did a survey of weak sources of radio waves in the early 1960s. These were distributed fairly uniformly across the sky, indicating that most of the sources lay outside our galaxy. The weaker sources would be further away, on average. The steady-state theory predicted a relationship between the number of sources and their strength. But the observations showed more faint sources than predicted, indicating that the density of the sources was higher in the past. This was contrary to the basic assumption of the steady-state theory, that everything was constant in time. For this and other reasons, the steady-state theory was abandoned. Another attempt to avoid the universe having a beginning was the suggestion that there was a previous contracting phase. but because of rotation and local irregularities, the matter would not all fall to the same point. Instead, different parts of the matter would miss each other, and the universe would expand again with the density always remaining finite. Two Russians, Evgeny Lifshitz and Isaac Kolatnikov, actually claimed to have proved that a general contraction without exact symmetry would always lead to a bounce, with the density remaining finite. This result was very convenient for Marxist-Leninist dialectical materialism, because it avoided awkward questions about the creation of the universe. It therefore became an article of faith for Soviet scientists. I began my research in cosmology just about the time that Lifshitz and Kolatnikov published their conclusion that the universe didn't have a beginning. I realized that this was a very important question, but I wasn't convinced by the arguments that Lifshitz and Kolatnikov had used. We are used to the idea that events are caused by earlier events, which in turn are caused by still earlier events. There is a chain of causality stretching back into the past. But suppose this chain has a beginning. Suppose there was a first event. What caused it? This was not a question many scientists wanted to address. They tried to avoid it, either by claiming, like the Russians and the steady-state theorists, that the universe didn't have a beginning, or by maintaining that the origin of the universe did not lie within the realm of science but belonged to metaphysics or religion. In my opinion, this is not a position any true scientist should take. If the laws of science are suspended at the beginning of the universe, might not they also fail at other times? A law is not a law if it only holds sometimes. I believe that we should try to understand the beginning of the universe on the basis of science. It may be a task beyond our powers, but at least we should make the attempt. Roger Penrose and I managed to prove geometrical theorems to show that the universe must have had a beginning if Einstein's general theory of relativity was correct, and certain reasonable conditions were satisfied. It is difficult to argue with a mathematical theorem, so in the end, Lifshitz and Kolatnikov conceded that the universe should have a beginning. Although the idea of a beginning to the universe might not be very welcome to communist ideas, ideology was never allowed to stand in the way of science in physics. Physics was needed for the bomb, and it was important that it worked. However, Soviet ideology did prevent progress in biology by denying the truth of genetics. Although the theorems Roger Penrose and I proved showed that the universe must have had a beginning, they did not give much information about the nature of that beginning. They indicated that the universe began in a Big Bang, a point where the whole universe and everything in it was scrunched up into a single point of infinite density, a space-time singularity. At this point, Einstein's general theory of relativity would have broken down. Thus one cannot use it to predict in what manner the universe began. One is left with the origin of the universe apparently being beyond the scope of science. Observational evidence to confirm the idea that the universe had a very dense beginning came in October 1965, a few months after my first singularity result, with the discovery of a faint background of microwaves throughout space. These microwaves are the same as those in your microwave oven, but very much less powerful. They would heat your pizza only to minus 270.4 degrees Celsius. Not much good for defrosting the pizza, let alone cooking it. You can actually observe these microwaves yourself. Those of you who remember analog televisions have almost certainly observed these microwaves. If you ever set your television to an empty channel, a few percent of the snow you saw on the screen was caused by this background of microwaves. The only reasonable interpretation of the background is that it is radiation left over from an early very hot and dense state. As the universe expanded, the radiation would have cooled until it is just the faint remnant we observe today. That the universe began with a singularity was not an idea that I or a number of other people were happy with. The reason Einstein's general relativity breaks down near the Big Bang is that it is what is called a classical theory. That is, it implicitly assumed what seems obvious from common sense, that each particle had a well-defined position and a well-defined speed. In such a so-called classical theory, if one knows the positions and speeds of all the particles in the universe at one time, one can calculate what they would be at any other time in the past or future. however. In the early 20th century, scientists discovered that they couldn't calculate exactly what would happen over very short distances. It wasn't just that they needed better theories. There seems to be a certain level of randomness or uncertainty in nature that cannot be removed however good our theories. It can be summed up in the uncertainty principle that was proposed in 1927 by the German scientist Werner Heisenberg. One cannot accurately predict both the position and the speed of a particle. The more accurately the position is predicted, the less accurately you will be able to predict the speed, and vice versa. Einstein objected strongly to the idea that the universe is governed by chance. His feelings were summed up in his dictum, "God does not play dice." But all the evidence is that God is quite a gambler. The universe is like a giant casino, with dice being rolled or wheels being spun on every occasion. A casino owner risks losing money each time dice are thrown or the roulette wheel is spun. But over a large number of bets, the odds average out, and the casino owner makes sure they average out in his or her favor. That's why casino owners are so rich. The only chance you have of winning against them is to stake all your money on a few rolls of the dice or spins of the wheel. It is the same with the universe. When the universe is big, there are a very large number of rolls of the dice, and the results average out to something one can predict. But when the universe is very small, near the Big Bang, there are only a small number of rolls of the dice, and the uncertainty principle is very important. In order to understand the origin of the universe, one therefore has to incorporate the uncertainty principle into Einstein's general theory of relativity. This has been the great challenge in theoretical physics for at least the last 30 years. We haven't solved it yet, but we've made a lot of progress. Now, suppose we try to predict the future. Because we only know some combination of position and speed of a particle, we cannot make precise predictions about the future positions and speeds of particles. We can only assign a probability to particular combinations of positions and speeds. Thus, there is a certain probability to a particular future of the universe. But now suppose we try to understand the past in the same way. Given the nature of the observations we can make now, all we can do is assign a probability to a particular history of the universe. Thus, the universe must have many possible histories, each with its own probability. There is a history of the universe in which England win the World Cup again, though maybe the probability is low. This idea that the universe has multiple histories may sound like science fiction, but it is now accepted as science fact. It is due to Richard Feynman, who worked at the eminently respectable California Institute of Technology and played the bongo drums in a strip joint up the road. Feynman's approach to understanding how things work is to assign to each possible history a particular probability, and then use this idea to make predictions. It works spectacularly well to predict the future, so we presume it works to retrodict the past, too. Scientists are now working to combine Einstein's general theory of relativity and Feynman's idea of multiple histories into a complete, unified theory that will describe everything that happens in the universe. This unified theory will enable us to calculate how the universe will evolve if we know its state at one time. But the unified theory will not in itself tell us how the universe began or what its initial state was. For that, we need something extra. We require what are known as boundary conditions, things that tell us what happens at the frontiers of the universe, the edges of space and time. But if the frontier of the universe was just at a normal point of space and time, we could go past it and claim the territory beyond as part of the universe. On the other hand, if the boundary of the universe was at a jagged edge where space or time was scrunched up and the density was infinite, it would be very difficult to define meaningful boundary conditions. So it is not clear what boundary conditions are needed. It seems there is no logical basis for picking one set of boundary conditions over another. However, Jim Hartle of the University of California, Santa Barbara, and I realized there was a third possibility. Maybe the universe has no boundary in space and time. At first sight, this seems to be in direct contradiction to the geometrical theorems that I mentioned earlier. These showed that the universe must have had a beginning, a boundary in time. However, in order to make Feynman's techniques mathematically well-defined, the mathematicians developed a concept called imaginary time. It isn't anything to do with the real time that we experience. It is a mathematical trick to make the calculations work, and it replaces the real time we experience. Our idea was to say that there was no boundary in imaginary time. That did away with trying to invent boundary conditions. We called this the no-boundary proposal. If the boundary condition of the universe is that it has no boundary in imaginary time, it won't have just a single history. There are many histories in imaginary time, and each of them will determine a history in real time. Thus we have a superabundance of histories for the universe. What picks out the particular history or set of histories that we live in from the set of all possible histories of the universe? One point that we can quickly notice is that many of these possible histories of the universe won't go through the sequence of forming galaxies and stars, something that was essential to our own development. It may be that intelligent beings can evolve without galaxies and stars, but it seems unlikely. Thus, the very fact that we exist as beings that can ask the question, why is the universe the way it is a restriction on the history we live in. It implies it is one of the minority of histories that have galaxies and stars. This is an example of what is called the anthropic principle. The anthropic principle says that the universe has to be more or less as we see it, because if it were different, there wouldn't be anyone here to observe it. Many scientists dislike the anthropic principle because it seems little more than hand-waving, and not to have much predictive power. But the anthropic principle can be given a precise formulation, and it seems to be essential when dealing with the origin of the universe. M-theory, which is our best candidate for a complete unified theory, allows a very large number of possible histories for the universe. Most of these histories are quite unsuitable for the development of intelligent life. Either they are empty, or too short-lasting, or too highly curved, or wrong in some other way. Yet, according to Richard Feynman's multiple histories idea, these uninhabited histories might have quite a high probability. We don't really care how many histories there may be that don't contain intelligent beings. We are interested only in the subset of histories in which intelligent life develops. This intelligent life need not be anything like humans. Little green men would do as well. In fact, they may do rather better. The human race does not have a very good record of intelligent behaviour. As an example of the power of the anthropic principle, consider the number of directions in space. It is a matter of common experience that we live in three-dimensional space. That is to say, we can represent the position of a point in space by three numbers, for example, latitude, longitude, and height above sea level. But why is space three-dimensional? Why isn't it two, or four, or some other number of dimensions, like in science fiction? In fact, in M-theory, space has 10 dimensions, as well as the theory having one dimension of time. But it is thought that 7 of the 10 spatial directions are curled up very small, leaving 3 directions that are large and nearly flat. It is like a drinking straw. The surface of a straw is two-dimensional. However, one direction is curled up into a small circle, so that from a distance the straw looks like a one-dimensional line. Why don't we live in a history in which 8 of the dimensions are curled up small, leaving only 2 dimensions that we notice? A two-dimensional animal would have a hard job digesting food. If it had a gut that went right through, like we have, it would divide the animal in 2, and the poor creature would fall apart. So 2 flat directions are not enough for anything as complicated as intelligent life. There is something special about 3 space dimensions. In 3 dimensions, planets can have stable orbits around stars. This is a consequence of gravitation, obeying the inverse square law as discovered by Robert Hooke in 1665 and elaborated on by Isaac Newton. Think about the gravitational attraction of 2 bodies at a particular distance. If that distance is doubled, then the force between them is divided by 4. If the distance is tripled, then the force is divided by 9. If quadrupled, then the force is divided by 16, and so on. This leads to stable planetary orbits. Now let's think about four space dimensions. There, gravitation would obey an inverse cube law. If the distance between two bodies is doubled, then the gravitational force would be divided by 8, tripled by 27, and if quadrupled, by 64. This change to an inverse cube law prevents planets from having stable orbits around their suns. They would either fall into their sun or escape to the outer darkness and cold. Similarly, the orbits of electrons in atoms would not be stable, so matter as we know it would not exist. Thus, although the multiple histories idea would allow any number of nearly flat directions, only histories with three flat directions will contain intelligent beings. Only in such histories will the question be asked, why does space have three dimensions? One remarkable feature of the universe we observe concerns the microwave background discovered by Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson. It is essentially a fossil record of how the universe was when very young. This background is almost the same independently of which direction one looks in. The differences between different directions is about one part in 100,000. These differences are incredibly tiny and need an explanation. The generally accepted explanation for this smoothness is that very early in the history of the universe, it underwent a period of very rapid expansion, by a factor of at least a billion, billion, billion. This process is known as inflation, something that was good for the universe in contrast to inflation of prices that too often plagues us. If that was all there was to it, the microwave radiation would be totally the same in all directions. So where did the small discrepancies come from? In early 1982, I wrote a paper proposing that these differences arose from the quantum fluctuations during the inflationary period. Quantum fluctuations occur as a consequence of the uncertainty principle. Furthermore, these fluctuations were the seeds for structures in our universe, galaxies, stars, and us. This idea is basically the same mechanism as so-called Hawking radiation from a black hole horizon, which I had predicted a decade earlier. Except that now it comes from a cosmological horizon, the surface that divided the universe between the parts that we can see and the parts that we cannot observe. We held a workshop in Cambridge that summer, attended by all the major players in the field. At this meeting, we established most of our present picture of inflation, including the all-important density fluctuations, which give rise to galaxy formation and so to our existence. Several people contributed to the final answer. This was 10 years before fluctuations in the microwave sky were discovered by the COBE satellite in 1993. So theory was way ahead of experiment. Cosmology became a precision science another 10 years later, in 2003, with the first results from the WMAP satellite. WMAP produced a wonderful map of the temperature of the cosmic microwave sky, a snapshot of the universe at about 1/100th of its present age. The irregularities you see are predicted by inflation, and they mean that some regions of the universe had a slightly higher density than others. The gravitational attraction of the extra density slows the expansion of that region, and can eventually cause it to collapse to form galaxies and stars. So look carefully at the map of the microwave sky. It is the blueprint for all the structure in the universe. We are the product of quantum fluctuations in the very early universe. God really does play dice. Superseding WMAP today, there is the Planck satellite, with a much higher resolution map of the universe. Planck is testing our theories in earnest and may even detect the imprint of gravitational waves predicted by inflation. This would be quantum gravity written across the sky. There may be other universes. M-theory predicts that a great many universes were created out of nothing, corresponding to the many different possible histories. Each universe has many possible histories and many possible states as they age to the present and beyond into the future. Most of these states will be quite unlike the universe we observe. There is still hope that we see the first evidence for M-theory at the LHC Particle Accelerator, the Large Hadron Collider at CERN in Geneva. From an M-theory perspective, it only probes low energies, but we might be lucky and see a weaker signal of fundamental theory such as supersymmetry. I think the discovery of supersymmetric partners for the known particles would revolutionize our understanding of the universe. In 2012, the discovery of the Higgs particle by the LHC at CERN in Geneva was announced. This was the first discovery of a new elementary particle in the 21st century. There is still some hope that the LHC will discover supersymmetry. But even if the LHC does not discover any new elementary particles, supersymmetry might still be found in the next generation of accelerators that are presently being planned. The beginning of the universe itself in the hot Big Bang is the ultimate high-energy laboratory for testing M-theory, and our ideas about the building blocks of space-time and matter. Different theories leave behind different fingerprints in the current structure of the universe. So astrophysical data can give us clues about the unification of all the forces of nature. So there may well be other universes, but unfortunately, we will never be able to explore them. We have seen something about the origin of the universe, but that leaves two big questions. Will the universe end? Is the universe unique? What then will be the future behavior of the most probable histories of the universe? There seem to be various possibilities which are compatible with the appearance of intelligent beings. They depend on the amount of matter in the universe. If there is more than a certain critical amount, the gravitational attraction between the galaxies will slow down the expansion. Eventually, they will then start falling towards each other and will all come together in a big crunch. That will be the end of the history of the universe in real time. When I was in the Far East, I was asked not to mention the big crunch because of the effect it might have on the market. But the markets crashed, so maybe the story got out somehow. In Britain, people don't seem too worried about a possible end 20 billion years in the future. We can do quite a lot of eating, drinking, and being merry before that. If the density of the universe is below the critical value, gravity is too weak to stop the galaxies flying apart forever. All the stars will burn out, and the universe will get emptier and emptier and colder and colder. So again, things will come to an end, but in a less dramatic way. Still, we have a few billion years in hand. In this answer, I have tried to explain something of the origins, future, and nature of our universe. The universe in the past was small and dense, and so it is quite like the nutshell with which I began. Yet this nut encodes everything that happens in real time. So Hamlet was quite right. We could be bounded in a nutshell and count ourselves kings of infinite space.
What came before the Big Bang?
According to the no-boundary proposal, asking what came before the Big Bang is meaningless, like asking what is south of the South Pole, because there is no notion of time available to refer to. The concept of time only exists within our universe.
3. Is there other intelligent life in the universe? I would like to speculate a little on the development of life in the universe, and in particular, on the development of intelligent life. I should take this to include the human race, even though much of its behavior throughout history has been pretty stupid, and not calculated to aid the survival of the species. Two questions I shall discuss are, what is the probability of life existing elsewhere in the universe, and how may life develop in the future? It is a matter of common experience that things get more disordered and chaotic with time. This observation even has its own law, the so-called second law of thermodynamics. This law says that the total amount of disorder or entropy in the universe always increases with time. However, the law refers only to the total amount of disorder. The order in one body can increase provided that the amount of disorder in its surroundings increases by a greater amount. This is what happens in a living being. We can define life as an ordered system that can keep itself going against the tendency to disorder and can reproduce itself. That is, it can make similar but independent ordered systems. To do these things, the system must convert energy in some ordered form, like food, sunlight, or electric power, into disordered energy in the form of heat. In this way, the system can satisfy the requirement that the total amount of disorder increases while at the same time increasing the order in itself and its offspring. This sounds like parents living in a house which gets messier and messier each time they have a new baby. A living being like you or me usually has two elements. A set of instructions that tell the system how to keep going and how to reproduce itself. And a mechanism to carry out the instructions. In biology, these two parts are called genes and metabolism. But it is worth emphasizing that there need be nothing biological about them. For example, a computer virus is a program that will make copies of itself in the memory of a computer and will transfer itself to other computers. Thus it fits the definition of a living system that I have given. Like a biological virus, it is a rather degenerate form because it contains only instructions or genes and doesn't have any metabolism of its own. Instead, it reprograms the metabolism of the host computer or cell. Some people have questioned whether viruses should count as life because they are parasites and cannot exist independently of their hosts. But then most forms of life, ourselves included, are parasites, in that they feed off and depend for their survival on other forms of life. I think computer viruses should count as life. Maybe it says something about human nature, that the only form of life we have created so far is purely destructive. Talk about creating life in our own image. I shall return to electronic forms of life later on. What we normally think of as life is based on chains of carbon atoms, with a few other atoms such as nitrogen or phosphorus. One can speculate that one might have life with some other chemical basis such as silicon, but carbon seems the most favorable case because it has the richest chemistry. That carbon atoms should exist at all, with the properties that they have, requires a fine adjustment of physical constants, such as the QCD scale, the electric charge, and even the dimension of space-time. If these constants has significantly different values, either the nucleus of the carbon atom would not be stable, or the electrons would collapse in on the nucleus. At first sight, it seems remarkable that the universe is so finely tuned. Maybe this is evidence that the universe was specially designed to produce the human race. However, one has to be careful about such arguments because of the anthropic principle, the idea that our theories about the universe must be compatible with our own existence. This is based on the self-evident truth that if the universe had not been suitable for life, we wouldn't be asking why it is so finely adjusted. One can apply the anthropic principle in either its strong or weak versions. For the strong anthropic principle, one supposes that there are many different universes, each with different values of the physical constants. In a small number, the values will allow the existence of objects like carbon atoms, which can act as the building blocks of living systems. Since we must live in one of these universes, we should not be surprised that the physical constants are finely tuned. If they weren't, we wouldn't be here. The strong form of the anthropic principle is thus not very satisfactory, because what operational meaning can one give to the existence of all those other universes? And if they are separate from our own universe, how can what happens in them affect our universe? Instead, I shall adopt what is known as the weak anthropic principle. That is, I shall take the values of the physical constants as given. But I shall see what conclusions can be drawn from the fact that life exists on this planet at this stage in the history of the universe. There was no carbon when the universe began in the Big Bang about 13.8 billion years ago. It was so hot that all the matter would have been in the form of particles called protons and neutrons. There would initially have been equal numbers of protons and neutrons. However, as the universe expanded, it cooled. About a minute after the Big Bang, the temperature would have fallen to about a billion degrees, about 100 times the temperature in the sun. At this temperature, neutrons start to decay into more protons. If this had been all that had happened, all the matter in the universe would have ended up as the simplest element, hydrogen, whose nucleus consists of a single proton. However, some of the neutrons collided with protons and stuck together to form the next simplest element, helium, whose nucleus consists of 2 protons and 2 neutrons. But no heavier elements, like carbon or oxygen, would have been formed in the early universe. It is difficult to imagine that one could build a living system out of just hydrogen and helium. And anyway, the early universe was still far too hot for atoms to combine into molecules. The universe continued to expand and cool. But some regions had slightly higher densities than others, and the gravitational attraction of the extra matter in those regions slowed down their expansion and eventually stopped it. Instead, they collapsed to form galaxies and stars, starting from about 2 billion years after the Big Bang. Some of the early stars would have been more massive than our Sun. They would have been hotter than the Sun and would have burned the original hydrogen and helium into heavier elements, such as carbon, oxygen, and iron. This could have taken only a few 100 million years. After that, some of the stars exploded as supernovae and scattered the heavy elements back into space to form the raw material for later generations of stars. Other stars are too far away for us to be able to see directly if they have planets going around them. However, there are two techniques that have enabled us to discover planets around other stars. The first is to look at the star and see if the amount of light coming from it is constant. If a planet moves in front of the star, the light from the star will be slightly obscured. The star will dim a little bit. If this happens regularly, it is because a planet's orbit is taking it in front of the star repeatedly. A second method is to measure the position of the star accurately. If a planet is orbiting the star, it will induce a small wobble in the position of the star. This can be observed, and again, if it is a regular wobble, then one deduces that it is due to a planet in orbit around the star. These methods were first applied about 20 years ago, and by now a few thousand planets have been discovered orbiting distant stars. It is estimated that one star in five has an Earth-like planet orbiting it at a distance from the star to be compatible with life as we know it. Our own solar system was formed about 4.5 billion years ago, or a little more than 9 billion years after the Big Bang, from gas contaminated with the remains of earlier stars. The Earth was formed largely out of the heavier elements, including carbon and oxygen. Somehow, some of these atoms came to be arranged in the form of molecules of DNA. This is the famous double helix form, discovered in the 1950s by Francis Crick and James Watson in a hut on the New Museum site in Cambridge. Linking the two chains in the helix are pairs of nucleic acids. There are four types of nucleic acids: adenine, cytosine, guanine, and thymine. An adenine on one chain is always matched with a thymine on the other chain, and a guanine with a cytosine. Thus, the sequence of nucleic acids on one chain defines a unique, complementary sequence on the other chain. The two chains can then separate, and each acts as a template to build further chains. Thus, DNA molecules can reproduce the genetic information coded in their sequences of nucleic acids. Sections of the sequence can also be used to make proteins and other chemicals, which can carry out the instructions coded in the sequence and assemble the raw material for DNA to reproduce itself. As I said earlier, we do not know how DNA molecules first appeared. As the chances against a DNA molecule arising by random fluctuations are very small, some people have suggested that life came to Earth from elsewhere, for instance, brought here on rocks breaking off from Mars while the planets were still unstable, and that there are seeds of life floating around in the galaxy. However, it seems unlikely that DNA could survive for long in the radiation in space. If the appearance of life on a given planet was very unlikely, one might have expected it to take a long time. More precisely, one might have expected life to appear as late as possible while still allowing time for the subsequent evolution to intelligent beings like us, before the sun swells up and engulfs the Earth. The time window in which this could occur is the lifetime of the sun, about 10 billion years. In that time, an intelligent form of life could conceivably master space travel and be able to escape to another star. But if no escape is possible, life on Earth would be doomed. There is fossil evidence that there was some form of life on Earth about 3.5 billion years ago. This may have been only 500 million years after the Earth became stable and cool enough for life to develop. But life could have taken 7 billion years to develop in the universe and still have left time to evolve to beings like us, who could ask about the origin of life. If the probability of life developing on a given planet is very small, why did it happen on Earth in about 1/14 of the time available? The early appearance of life on Earth suggests that there is a good chance of the spontaneous generation of life in suitable conditions. Maybe there was some simpler form of organization which built up DNA. Once DNA appeared, it would have been so successful that it might have completely replaced the earlier forms. We don't know what these earlier forms would have been, but one possibility is RNA. RNA is like DNA, but rather simpler and without the double helix structure. Short lengths of RNA could reproduce themselves like DNA and might eventually build up to DNA. We cannot make nucleic acids in the laboratory from non-living material. But given 500 million years and oceans covering most of the Earth, there might be a reasonable probability of RNA being made by chance. As DNA reproduced itself, there would have been random errors, many of which would have been harmful and would have died out. Some would have been neutral. They would not have affected the function of the gene. And a few errors would have been favorable to the survival of the species. These would have been chosen by Darwinian natural selection. The process of biological evolution was very slow at first. It took about 2.5 billion years before the earliest cells evolved into multicellular organisms. But it took less than another 1 billion years for some of these to evolve into fish, and for some of the fish, in turn, to evolve into mammals. Then, evolution seems to have speeded up even more. It took only about 100 million years to develop from the early mammals to us. The reason is that the early mammals already contained their versions of the essential organs we have. All that was required to evolve from early mammals to humans was a bit of fine-tuning. But with the human race, evolution reached a critical stage, comparable in importance with the development of DNA. This was the development of language, and particularly written language. It meant that information could be passed on from generation to generation other than genetically through DNA. There has been some detectable change in human DNA brought about by biological evolution in the 10,000 years of recorded history. But the amount of knowledge handed on from generation to generation has grown enormously. I have written books to tell you something of what I have learned about the universe in my long career as a scientist, and in doing so, I am transferring knowledge from my brain to the page so you can read it. The DNA in a human egg or sperm contains about 3 billion base pairs of nucleic acids. However, much of the information coded in this sequence seems to be redundant or is inactive. So the total amount of useful information in our genes is probably something like 100 million bits. One bit of information is the answer to a yes-no question. By contrast, a paperback novel might contain 2 million bits of information. Therefore, a human is equivalent to about 50 Harry Potter books, and a major national library can contain about 5 million books, or about 10 trillion bits. The amount of information handed down in books or via the internet is 100,000 times as much as there is in DNA. Even more important is the fact that the information in books can be changed and updated much more rapidly. It has taken us several 1 million years to evolve from less advanced earlier apes. During that time, the useful information in our DNA has probably changed by only a few 1 million bits, so the rate of biological evolution in humans is about a bit a year. By contrast, there are about 50,000 new books published in the English language each year, containing of the order of 100 billion bits of information. Of course, the great majority of this information is garbage and no use to any form of life. But even so, the rate at which useful information can be added is millions, if not billions, higher than with DNA. This means that we have entered a new phase of evolution. At first, evolution proceeded by natural selection, from random mutations. This Darwinian phase lasted about 3.5 billion years and produced us, beings who developed language to exchange information. But in the last 10,000 years or so, we have been in what might be called an external transmission phase. In this, the internal record of information, handed down to succeeding generations in DNA, has changed somewhat, but the external record in books and other long-lasting forms of storage has grown enormously. Some people would use the term evolution only for the internally transmitted genetic material and would object to it being applied to information handed down externally. But I think